This is David Hausman, and I'm here with Judy Parfitt in Parkview on February 27th, 2010. Ms. Parfitt, have you agreed to be recorded for this interview?
Yes, I have.
Great. I wanted to start by asking you a bit about your career background and what jobs you had that led you to become a general manager of human resources at SARS.
Okay. Well, I have a fairly checkered career. I started off in journalism, and that was in the late 70s and the first half of the 80s, which was a very interesting time to be a journalist in South Africa. And then I became quite interested in trade unions and was fairly active in the trade union for journalists at the time. So, and then because of censorship of the press during the state of emergency, I went back to study and studied industrial relations and then stayed on as a lecturer and researcher. Did that for 7 years. Then I got a scholarship to study abroad. I studied at Warwick in the UK, a master's in international relations. And my research project was on the role of multinationals in national politics. So I did a case study on Volkswagen South Africa and was offered a job there. That was also a fascinating time because that was in the years around the first democratic elections. Trade unions, as you know, were at the vanguard of the struggle. Then after I'd been at Volkswagen for about 4 years, I helped to establish the Commission for Conciliation, Mediation and Arbitration in South Africa. And specifically set up the Eastern Cape region. And then I was approached by SARS and never ever had contemplated a career in revenue administration, but met with the then Deputy Minister Jill Marcus and met Pravin Gordhan. I hadn't known him before. And was persuaded to join. So that's the background leading up to that.
Do you have an idea of how they found you and decided to hunt for you?
I actually don't. What I do know is that it was word of mouth. So I had previously interviewed Jill when I was in journalism, but I'm not sure if she remembered me from that time.
And were many of your colleagues at SARS hired in the same way?
Not when I joined. Hang on a second, let me qualify that. The hiring practices at SARS pre-1990s many of the people in those roles were in protected employment, really. It was a jobs for votes policy. So most of the people working there would have been ardent Nationalist Party supporters. And in fact, the people who had been hired in the customs section of the business, some of them were really quite dubious characters, and their role had been sanctions busting. So I suppose it was appropriate that some of them were fairly thuggish. But then from the 90s onwards, there was, I think, a much stronger merit-based approach to recruitment. But there are several people in senior positions at SARS, not several, but some, who do have a history, like Ivan Pillay and Pravin Gordhan. So I think it's a combination of having the right qualities and also having relationships that are steeped in trust. Yeah.
And what year did you say you
I joined in 1998, yeah.
And can you describe some of the biggest human resources challenges in the, I guess, it was already the...
SARS,
yeah. It was already SARS at the time. Can you describe some of the biggest challenges?
You know, David, it was so broken. And so many of the practices were outdated and inappropriate. So from a human resources point of view, the fact that SARS was given administrative autonomy was absolutely critical to the changes that ensued. And we changed everything, from the grading system to the performance management system to the remuneration system. We changed the labor relations dispensation, administration of grievances, recruitment and selection. Everything changed. And, I mean, with the benefit of hindsight, I think it's appropriate to say that we changed. We were probably far too ambitious in the scale of the change and the timeframes for that change. But I think that things got done. And there was such a strong sense of higher purpose around making the tax administration more efficient and effective. And that became a clarion call, if you like, for mobilizing people. And it was one that found easy resonance amongst the staff, even though many of them were not necessarily loyal to the ANC. So the scale of the change was huge.
Before I ask you more about the change, and I'd like to ask you about each different kind in detail, can I ask about how the practices were outdated and inappropriate in more detail?
I think probably one of the hallmarks of what was dysfunctional about HR at SARS was that people were rewarded for loyalty rather than competence. And that meant that tenure was the primary determinant of role and pay. Plus, it was a very hierarchical organization with a marked command and control approaches to management. So one of the changes that we introduced was radical delayering and reducing the levels in the organization, introducing team-based approaches to work organization and design. And I think it's important to say that not all of these things happened entirely smoothly. There were hiccups, but broadly speaking, the changes to the human resources systems, policies, practices, etc., along with wider organizational reform, started quite quickly to engender the behavioral changes that were being sought.
So let me now just go through the changes one by one, if I could, starting with recruitment.
Right.
So how did recruitment work when you arrived, and then how did you change it?
It used to be an incredibly bureaucratic process. And David, I must say I can't remember the detail of what it was like before, but what we introduced were a more competency-based approach to recruitment and selection. What were then unorthodox sourcing processes, including web-based processes, but also working through agencies that we knew would source good black talent, because the demographics of the organization in 1998 were hopelessly unrepresentative. For managers, we introduced leadership competency assessment, and that was informed by a competency framework that was designed for the new SARS manager. And that framework derived in turn from the organizational strategy. So we were looking for obviously job-specific knowledge and skills, but there were generic competencies that were tested for all managers, including a collaborative working style, including a values fit.
How do you test that?
So we worked with a psychometrist to design role plays and simulations, and we also used some off-the-shelf psychometric tests. And you alluded earlier to, with Siaka and the restructuring, we decided that all the management jobs were going to be up for grabs. And no one would be appointed to a management role unless they were successful in this assessment process. So many of the existing managers weren't successful and either chose to exit or were redeployed. I think another critical success factor to the successes that SARS did achieve was a compact that we reached with the unions. So David, when I joined, the approach to union recognition was an all-comers approach. And my sense is, I don't know this for a fact, but that management saw this as an opportunity to divide and rule. So we negotiated a new recognition agreement which obliged a minimum level of representativity for a union to be recognized, which reduced the number of recognized unions to two. That was significant. Also, we were very careful not to play them off against each other, because the one union had a predominantly white membership and the other union had predominantly black membership. And there was a very concerted effort led by Pravin to ensure non-racialism in the organization. So, I mean, to the extent that there were ideological differences between the unions that started to play themselves out in collective bargaining situations, we would sometimes try and help them get beyond those differences.
And which were those two unions?
It was the PSA, they're still there, Public Servants Association, which is an affiliate of FEDUSA, which is a non-aligned union federation. And the other one is NEHAWU, and NEHAWU, and they're an affiliate of COSATU.
And you mentioned before that you looked to work through agencies that you knew would source good black talent. Which agencies were those?
The one that we used at the time, I think it was black owned at the time, was it's still around, it's called Landelani. And the spelling of that is a bit unusual. It's Landelhani.
And what sort of agency was that?
It was a recruitment agency. But we also, what was also a bit unorthodox, David, is that, for example, we would hire black school teachers, accountancy teachers, for example. Now, so we look quite carefully at the specifications for jobs to assess whether they were not perhaps overstated, given the need to bring in black people. So, I mean, I can think of two people. One was actually a shop steward in Port Elizabeth, but who had very obvious leadership qualities. Oh, that was the other thing we did, is that we said to black people and women in the organization that if they felt they had leadership potential, they could put their hands up for this assessment, okay? And then when jobs became available, if they performed well in the assessment, they would be considered as applicants for those jobs. So this man was one of those. And, I mean, he later became a branch manager in Port Elizabeth. There was another woman who was an accountancy teacher at a coloured school in Johannesburg. And she also rose through the ranks very quickly. So that was also a bit unorthodox. And I think it worked. Our sense was that, I mean, there's so few chartered accountants who are certified by the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. The number of black CAs is so small. So we spoke to them about accelerating the production is the wrong word, but the throughput of black CAs weren't warmly received, and decided then to rather form links with ACCA, which I think is the Association of Certified Chartered Accountants. It's an international body, and the threshold for admission to their programs is lower than the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants one. And so with ACCA and with one of the local universities, we developed a program that would first of all admit black people who with a lower entry threshold, and secondly had a stronger tax element to it. And that worked well. If I can come back to the unions, because that was quite important. The scale of the change, David, associated with SIACA was massive. So the majority of employees in the organization, either what they did changed, or how they did it changed, or where they did it because there were some relocations, or when they did it because sometimes working hours changed, and in some instances all those things. So in an organization that was more than 80% unionized, and significantly the majority of managers were also union members, getting them on board was absolutely critical. And I think that the unions, They were understandably wary, but the fact again that SARS was an agency and that any agreement concluded there wouldn't have application in the wider public service, I think made them willing to engage. And we engaged intensively and on everything. So sharing the strategy, getting a commitment to the strategic intent, and then negotiating in the finest detail how the impact of the transformation on people would be dealt with. And that it was called the SIACA Protocol. And I mean, we had, it took, if I remember correctly, it took about 8 months to negotiate. And then we had joint roadshows countrywide, where union leaders and SARS leaders would present on the rationale for the agreement, and what it meant.
These were internal roadshows.
Yeah. So, and we co-scripted those presentations, and so without them, there would probably have been, and this isn't an exaggeration, there would probably have been about 5,000 grievances. But because that agreement was there, the thing held, process held. And when there were unanticipated consequences, or when something went wrong, then we get back to the drawing board and thrash that out. And of course, we agreed that it would be piloted in one region first. Yeah.
And were there specific concessions that you made in the negotiations? Yes. Any particular ones?
Look, the pact was around two things. First of all, the minister at the time made it clear that retrenchments were not an option because unemployment is too much of an issue. And I remember thinking how remarkable that was because of the political allegiances of most of the employees who were going to keep their jobs, even though many of them might not deserve to be there. So I, in fact, was advocating retrenchments, and the minister blocked that. And I still admire and respect him for that. So David, the quid pro quo was this. SARS gave, first of all, employment security guarantees. Not job security guarantees, employment security guarantees. So you wouldn't be retrenched, but you might land up doing a completely different job. We also gave pay protection guarantees for a limited period. So if you found yourself in a lower graded job after the restructuring, you would retain your earnings, if I remember correctly, it was for 2 years, during which time you would have an opportunity to up your game or receive training. We didn't always get that right. And if you cracked it, then there would be no impact on pay. If you didn't, then you'd start being paid the rate for the job. So it was pay protection for 2 years and employment security in exchange for flexibility. Flexibility about what you did, where you did it, when you did it, and how you did it. And I think that's fairly unique in the public service. Because the rest of the public service, certainly in South Africa, is so rule-bound and so inflexible. Both parties.
And were many people moved around physically?
Yeah.
For example, from branch offices to the center.
Yes, that happened. Also, because you understand, David, that in the apartheid years, large tracts of the country were underserviced or not serviced at all. So a key feature of SIACA was to create a SARS presence in those places. And by the same token, predominantly white areas had been over-serviced, relatively speaking. So to give an example, there was a large office in Pietermaritzburg, which is less than an hour away from Durban, which has its own large office. So just to continue with that example, the Pietermaritzburg office was downsized quite radically, and people working there were deployed to Durban.
Great. Let me go back now to our kind of list of different changes and ask you about how promotion procedures changed.
Look, first of all, in promotions in the past, there was a notch system, and it was largely time-based. So if you'd been in a job for a certain length of time, then you'd move to the next notch. And I'm not convinced at all that was a merit-based system, even though there were structures in place that were ostensibly regulating progression. So that was the first thing. The second thing was that there was very little room for lateral movement. A third feature was that the system was designed in such a way that you could, after a point, only increase your earnings if you became a manager. So that a lot of very capable specialists who were very inadequate managers, that was their only way of movement up the organization. So all those things were changed. I'm just trying to think what else was changed about promotion. We abolished that notch system and introduced... And these were, this system needed a lot of subsequent refinement, but career paths for key job families. So, for example, with auditors, given the shift in organizational strategy towards a stronger enforcement orientation, in addition to the service aspect, we wanted to radically increase the number of auditors in the business. So with that career path, that was about identifying with the auditors in the business levels of complexity in that field and identifying key inputs and key outputs and the standards for those outputs. And then everyone who was in that sort of role in the business was assessed and located on that career path. And there was no ceiling on progression up that career ladder because it was going to take decades to meet the need. Whereas, for example, in the back office processing roles, progression up those career ladders was largely vacancy driven because there wasn't a serious skills shortage there, and certainly relative to the auditing role, a degree of substitutability.
And what sort of outputs did you find for the auditors?
And I'm really going to have to dredge my memory here, David, but I think the sorts of criteria that would have differentiated, if I remember correctly, the levels of complexity of auditing work were, for example, how many tax types the auditor was dealing with. So historically, you had VAT auditors and PAYE auditors and company tax auditors. So part of the new way of working at SARS was to have auditors audit all the tax types. So that was one criterion. Another would be the size of the organization that was being audited. And then there were others, all of which related to how much more complex the auditing job was, whether it was a multinational, for example. Whether there were elements of transfer pricing that needed attention.
Great. And so as you changed these promotion policies, what changes did you make to pay policy?
So what we did was, and this was part of flattening the organization, we introduced broadbanded approaches to remuneration. And so generally speaking, and again, market factors played a role here, people would come in at the entry level of the band for that particular career path or for that job. And then progress was competency driven to the extent that there was an unlimited need for progress, but it was all performance based. The performance management system. And we're still, I still have an involvement with SARS. I chair there's a statutory committee on human resources and remuneration, and I chair that committee. It's performance management systems, embedding and institutionalizing them is always a challenge. So, but it's been great to watch how that's got better and better over the years.
So this is exactly my next question. There are, of course, lots and lots of challenges associated with performance management systems, and often when they're introduced, they're either ignored or resented. How did you avoid those problems?
Look, they were both of those things presented. I mean, there was training, there was monitoring, there was moderating of scores. So initially there was this tendency to sort of average rate and over rate. And I speak under correction, but I think we did, and I might be getting confused with other work I've done. I think there was a normalization of performance scores that was undertaken. Also, for variable reward, David, there's a remarkably, I can't claim any credit for this, it happened after I'd left, a remarkably sophisticated performance management system in place around targets. So there's the individual-based performance management system and then this collective system. And each year it's fine-tuned and becomes more sophisticated and the information becomes even more reliable.
And I've been told that, at least at the beginning of the reforms, the way bonuses worked was that everyone got a bonus when the agency met its target. What were the effects of that?
Yeah. Look, so first of all, everyone got a bonus when we joined, and the bonus was, in our view, unduly generous. And I forget what the percentage was, David, but I think we more than halved it. Okay. A, because we were introducing competitive pay. So we weren't paying, I think we were paying just below market median at SARS. That was a key shift. So we were saying, A, that bonus doesn't differentiate enough because everyone gets it, even the shirkers. And B, we're now paying market-related pay. And then started work, and this is the work that I'm talking about that's continued, nuancing that system so that the bonus is largely team-based now or divisional-based. And this was a big thrust on the part of the previous minister, Minister Manuel, was that it wasn't to be just about revenue collection. Okay, so we introduced several other indicators into that system relating to enforcement, relating to service, and relating to improved efficiencies. So I think that that addressed the concerns of a lot of critics who felt, and probably correctly, that when the old system was in place, that SARS officials were being far too assertive and robust in chasing money, because that was the sole criterion for eligibility for a bonus.
And was there not a lot of resistance to these changes?
There was. And again, I come back to the collective agreements. Because the resistance would probably have been unmanageable without them. That's not to say that management and the unions held hands and walked into the sunset. There were some bitter disagreements and a couple of disputes and one or two narrowly averted strikes. But I think a deep trust and this very powerful shared commitment to creating a better life for all. It was a wonderfully mobilizing concept. The way that I used to package messages around the changes was to try to elucidate what's in it for you, what's in it for SARS, and what's in it for the country. Those were the sort of themes around communication of all the changes that were being introduced. So for performers in SARS, the future looked very rosy. Jobs were being enriched, performance-based progression was being introduced, etc. For the dissenters, they might have been a little less enthusiastic. But David, the approach to change management was, first of all, recognize that there would be a group of devotees, a small group of strong dissenters, and a bunch of undecideds in the middle. So we worked hard on those undecideds to understand what made them anxious or resistant, to try to correct misconceptions, to push and pull and persuade. When it came to sabotage, though, we dealt with that very robustly.
For example,
there was a manager who was a fairly powerful individual in Mpumalanga, and who was playing an incredibly negative role, but thought he was doing it covertly, and it wasn't covert. Anyway, he made the mistake of treating a black employee in a very racist way, and we lost no time in firing him, but making an example of that as well. On discipline generally, any behavior that was dishonest, and obviously especially fraud and theft, it was name and shame in a very public way.
And you mentioned before that there were a couple of issues where you very nearly came to a standstill in your talks with the union. Which issues were those?
Look, you can imagine, I think the biggest one was that automatic pay progression. They were very relieved to have the employment security. They were excited about the prospects of enriched jobs, etc. But the pay progression thing was the one that they were most wary about. That was not the subject of a collective agreement, not in detail. It was just the principle. And in fact, David, with those career paths, what we didn't get right, and I left it about this time, was that we didn't have proper training material ready to facilitate the career progression. So that there was a bit of a vacuum that was created. And the unions were very disaffected by that. And there was a dispute about that a couple of years later. So that was a big source of unhappiness.
So you were describing the lack of training material for facilitating this career progression.
Yeah. So there was material, but not material that was properly aligned with the career paths, and not nearly enough of it. So I think there was something of a crisis of expectations around that.
Great. So let me ask you a couple more general questions. Mm. I've heard a lot about the gradual transition to a performance and service culture in SARS. What do you think were the most important factors in establishing that culture? Do you think it was established by the changes in these formal procedures, or rather that the formal procedures worked because the culture was changing, or some combination of the two?
I think it's a combination. It's a tricky one. It's a difficult one to answer. Sort of the chicken and egg. It was a combination of the two. But I'd like to think that the HR side contributed significantly, but I don't think that was the dominant contributor. Having said that, we were testing for service orientation, for customer-facing jobs. So that would have played a role. But, when I think back on it now, it is remarkable because a lot of the people who found themselves in service jobs had worked in dark, windowless offices before, probably couldn't speak the language of the people that they were serving initially, some of them. And again, this is not to suggest that everything went swimmingly, David, but when I think about it now, there's so much that could have gone wrong that didn't. But I think the role that Pravin Gordhan played cannot be underestimated. He is such an activist and such a good campaigner. And all those qualities that had served him so well in his underground days just found perfect expression in that environment. So his ability to engage and mobilize was huge. And this is that old story or cliche about success building on success, because the other thing that Pravin was good at was, and was
publicizing successes. And those would be fed back into the organization as well. So I think there was, you know, it developed a momentum that was, quite a significant momentum. It would have been hard to stop it, yeah.
Do you remember when that momentum started to form? Did you already have a sense of it when you first arrived, or did it?
No. You know, I'm sure, I don't know if Praveen spoke about this, but we arrived within a month of each other. And, I mean, David, I remember going into my office, being shown my office, and I mean, the smell of the place, it was, and the look and feel of it, it was, I just started thinking, what have I let myself in for? Because it just felt so antiquated. So when did the momentum start? I think probably, because after Praveen had been there a year in a deputy commissioner role, he was appointed commissioner. And David, I think that when that happened, we also changed the composition of the executive committee radically. So I don't remember the percentage, but it was probably about 70% of the people on the executive committee changed. It's important to note that there were long-serving SARS people like Kwesi Lowe and Tinus Marks, who either stayed on the exco in Kwesi's instance or were brought onto the exco in Tinus's instance, because they had seized the new vision and were very competent in their own right, but also enjoyed an enormous amount of support in the traditional SARS constituencies. So I don't remember exactly, but I think that momentum probably started to pick up sort of 1999, 2000, yeah.
Great. Well, thanks so much. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Just that it was fantastic to be part of it all, and it was exhausting. So we worked, David, 75-hour weeks, and it certainly felt very, very worthwhile. Suppose also something that saddens me is that I wish that the money was being better spent. And because there are several government departments that I'm in a consulting job now, and do some work in public sector organizations, and some of them are very broken. But there you go.
Okay, thank you.